your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Robin. Welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, September 14th, 2025, as we record this new episode. You know, it's tough being a Southside Chicago sports fan these days. On Sunday, I joined our friends, the Chicago Sports Bums, at the Remova Theater for the Chicago Bears watch party. It was a good time. Beer, brunch buffet, that's hard to beat. The Bears game, awful. And I, as I'm sure you are listening to this podcast, you might have already heard your Bears podcast. And boy, the outlook is bleak right now for the Chicago Bears. I wish I could say it was a good weekend for the White Sox, but it wasn't. They got swept by the Cleveland Guardians. So what are we going to talk about in this episode? There's 12 games left in the season, and suddenly, the MLB postseason races are much tighter. We're going to take a look at what's ahead in the American and National League West, but of a lot of tension at the wildcard races, with the New York Mets fumbling the bag, and with how things are going in the American League West, a good team making a late run is going to be in the outside looking in as the season concludes. We'll also preview the upcoming home series for the White Sox as the Baltimore Orioles come into town. So let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen. Jim, the White Sox swept again in Cleveland. As you wrote on SoxMachine.com, they finished 2-11 against the Guardians in 2025. And just like in April, the White Sox only scored 3 runs in this series. So 6 games in Cleveland this year, just 6 runs. Any idea why the White Sox could not score runs in Cleveland in 2025?
I'm more surprised by this series than the one earlier in the year. Like, they were better equipped. They had better handedness balance. The Guardians did not add at the deadline. They were not a better team necessarily after the deadline than they were before, although they're playing like it. So, like, I expected, you know, if not an easy series or, like, not expecting a whole lot of crooked numbers, at least more of a fight. I was expecting, 33 strikeouts against 2 walks the entire series. That was surprising. Kind of looking at it, when you look at the pitch data for everybody involved, the one thing I noticed is, like, the Guardians did not miss low with fastballs. Like, when you look at their pitch, their pitch maps for all 3 starters, like, all of the red 4-seam fastball dots are top half of the zone and above. So that's the first thing that jumps out. If they are an aggressive fastball hitting team, they did not really miss with fastball locations all that often. And then, you know, I think when they show the ability to command other pitches early in the count with regularity, like Tanner Bibee did early on, just like dotting the inside corner with cutters and then, you know, throwing curveballs in there and just making them guard half of the plate, you know, both quadrants up and down on that side of the plate, that I think it does temper their aggression against fastballs and kind of neutralize them. So aside from like 3 games in a row where nothing went right offensively, that would be like my leading theory, is that, you know, oftentimes this fastball hitting version of the White Sox, when it doesn't go well, you see like pitchers pitching backwards. It wasn't quite that, but I think the Guardians just did a very good job of executing the pitches they're called execute. And the White Sox didn't draw it out enough. They didn't have long enough at bats to create mistakes, and they didn't do a good job of hitting like the hittable strikes that were there, just because they weren't maybe the fattest pitches that they could have seen. And I think things snowballed.
The White Sox pitchers, I thought, in 6 games against the Guardians this year in Cleveland, they only allowed 20 runs. So it's not like Cleveland is blowing the White Sox out of the water in Cleveland, Jim. These have been competitive games that the White Sox are in. But to your point, they just cannot find that extra hit or can get a rally going. Even the home runs dried up for the White Sox in Cleveland this year.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of embodies both teams. One team is very good at maximizing the margins and getting by with less than stellar talent, or sometimes not even an outfield they get by with. And the White Sox just, they're, what's their record? 12-33 or something like that, 1-run games. Like, they are very used to Having things go against them or not capitalizing and you know, having one inning go by the boards that they should have, you know, made more of, and then you know, the bullpen comes and shuts them down. So I think the White Sox, you know, we're seeing them embody or try to emulate the Brewers a lot in terms of how they want to go about their business. But I think the Guardians aren't a terrible example either in terms of, like, with the talent you have, how do you win more games? How do you try to win more with three runs or four runs? I think they're another team to that can serve as role models.
And Cleveland consistently proves in recent years that they are comfortable winning these tight 3-2, 4-3 type of ball games. James, from a manager's perspective, this is Will Venable's first year with the Chicago White Sox. When you have this level of struggles at one particular place, maybe against one particular team, it's not a great record for the White Sox against the American League Central this year. Do managers ever open up and talk about how sometimes they have to prepare differently against a team, or maybe even against a team in their home stadium?
Probably in a more concentrated, we are doing the same thing over and over again situation. I think maybe if this is 2021 or 2022, where it's like a division crown centered team trying to figure out why they need to get over the hump of this situation, maybe it enters more. I mean, the biggest thing I think you would say if you're Will Venable is like, well, I've had a different roster every time I face them in some form, major way this year. Like, as far as like expecting lefties with power to like do something this weekend, that's probably not what we were thinking of when they went there earlier in the year. So I think it's probably a little bit light on sample to center it all around Cleveland. Like what Jim was saying with the strikeout to walk ugliness, that started happening in the Rays series. Even with there was some more production around it, they had like some game where it was like 13-1 or 13-0. And I asked Will about it at the time. He kind of thought it was more of a one-off because they're, strikeout rate had been one of the lowest in the league in the second half. But, you know, with Colson kind of in a funk of recent, the strikeouts really cropping up with him. You know, Lenin still being like this extreme chase guy, especially playing a team that like knows him really well and how to attack him. Like, one, he's just going to be kind of a hot and cold player at his current like orientation, probably forever with his approach. So never say forever with Lenin. I just don't think like necessarily they're what they've been relying on as engines to be the big surge, whether it's Colson, you know, hitting a home run every day or like the rookie catchers showing like no sign of wear or drip at any point during like their rookie season, you know, in the tail end of it. Maybe that's happening a little bit, you know, in terms of not seeing them have big performances of recent. I just don't think anything they had going was like, well, this, for there to be a hiccup in this, like we got to launch an investigation. It's got to be centered around this town. There's got to be some curse here. I just haven't kind of built like kind of the track record to really say it, but you know, when we talk to Will about game plan, when they seem like they're hitting their head a little bit, he's usually pointed to like, usually the biggest issue is them not performing against the fastball and coming it down to execution. Surprisingly enough, the coaching staff usually talks about execution more than the game plan being like needing to flip in some way. But I think they, there's generally room in what they've been preaching as far as like being aggressive or taking the opportunities or hitting fastballs to kind of point like, well, we certainly didn't do that as much as we could have at any given like offensive shortfall and probably be right. This is still not a team that's just like oozing with bat speed, especially losing Luis Robert Jr. So they kind of really have to be pretty keyed up to perform consistently against fastballs, especially the way they were, let alone to do it at an average level, like week to week. So they're just not that great yet where they're going to kill it every time out. And they clearly didn't do it this weekend.
Like the one example I can think of when talking about opponents and specific ballparks is like the Royals in the mid tens of, you know, when they were reaching their peak and just completely befuddling Robin Ventura's White Sox with base running, especially with their just ability to run rampant. That was, I think that was when maybe the White Sox deficiencies were exposed to the point where they had to talk about it. Like, we're terrible at the running game, or they just take the extra bases every way possible. And usually it takes the form of, we have to tighten it up, and they never tighten up. But yeah, perhaps the roster has changed too much in this regard, especially going from like early season, late season, rookies being promoted, veterans being traded to where just everybody is learning something about themselves every time the White Sox play the Guardians, and they probably, yeah, probably individuals have to amass some data points.
I mean, sure. I think we all have memories of watching them play in a Coffin Stadium, and like Alex Rios works along at bat and hits like a majestic 450-foot solo homer, and then the next inning the Royals tie it up with a walk, swinging bunt and a throwing error, and then it feels like you're kind of starting from the bottom again. And like, well, what are ways that we can happen into these runs that they are? But I don't know if there's like the kind of baseline understanding of what this White Sox office is going to be quite yet to say it like there's a to pin down a specific reason why it wouldn't work in Cleveland, other than like, I don't know, they pitch good, they defend well, and it's not a hitter haven.
Yeah, because the White Sox did not win a game in Cleveland or Kansas City this year, right, Jim?
Right.
That's weird. I mean, they won a series in Detroit. Detroit's not easy to hit in either. And then, of course, they won the season series against the Minnesota Twins this
Twins
year.
have to feel real stupid right now.
But not winning a game in Kansas City or Cleveland this year. So I guess we just chalk that up as that it's odd. Like, maybe it's not necessarily like a White Sox roster issue at this moment that they have to go in the offseason. You have to identify players that can hit well at Kauffman Stadium or Progressive Field. It's just, we just chalk this up as a weird thing that happened in 2025.
I think we say like the biggest thing you hear with young players and how to become consistent and good is like consistency. And these are inconsistent results that come from inconsistent players who are still developing.
Chase
Okay.
Mydroth was the only White Sox who homered. Like, how do
Oh, that's
you?
right. They did hit one home run
Yeah,
this
it's like
year.
how do you work backwards from that? And I think you just call it weird.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, yeah, the White Sox get swept by Cleveland. And now they come home. This is the final home stand of the season for the White Sox. They have three games against the Baltimore Orioles, a day off on Thursday, and they finish their home schedule against the San Diego Padres this upcoming weekend. Very busy weekend in Chicago. It's also Riot Fest that's going on in Chicago as well. So last hurrah for the city before fall sets in. The Baltimore Orioles, 69-80 this year, last place in the American League East. They have lost their last three games. However, their last 10, playing better baseball, they are 6-4. Away from Camden Yards this year, the Baltimore Orioles are 33-42. Season series, the White Sox got swept in Baltimore at the end of May going into June. The White Sox in those three games scored one run, two runs, and two runs. So, felt like Cleveland last time the White Sox played at Baltimore, getting swept by the Orioles. We'll see what happens this time in Chicago. Your pitching problems for this series, Monday night, September 15th, is Roberto Clemente Day. First pitch is at 6:40 p.m. Central Time. Kyle Bradish will take the ball for the Orioles as he starts to break off some rust for the White Sox against to be determined. For the White Sox, we'll touch on that in a moment. Tuesday night, again, first pitch is at 6:40 p.m. Central Time. For those that are on White Sox Twitter, this is the From the 108 bobblehead game. To be determined for Baltimore, Shane Smith will take the ball for the White Sox. And then on Getaway Day, Wednesday at 1:10 p.m. Central Time, it's to be determined for the Orioles, and it's Martin Perez taking the ball for the White Sox. Let's start from a White Sox perspective, James. What or any ideas that the White Sox have for the pitching plan on Monday against Baltimore?
It's Tyler Gilbert opening for Sean Burke, which I believe he's done in the past. I want to say specifically in Sacramento and led to one of Burke's better outings of the year. But Burke does not have like a actually like the most extreme splits in terms of results with lefties. It's more that lefties like tend to get him up in a lather and spamming, running up his pitch count and toggling between fastball curveball. And the article that we ran on Sunday was about him feeling like he's comfortable enough with his changeup to flip it in just enough. He threw it like three times in his first start up and felt like that was perfect. Just like when he needs it, he'll throw it, but not before. And that is kind of an establishing pitch. But obviously, the command needs to be better than lose it for a bit and walk the bases loaded. But at least from all signs, the way they treated him that first start wasn't like the most ringing endorsement. They got the bullpen up when he got in trouble in the second. And, like, pulled him pretty quick in the fifth, like when the lineup turned around for the third time. But I think certainly the easiest route to finishing out, essentially two more turns of the rotation is probably have him do it rather than force another bullpen gamer on bullpen that's worked, I think, at least top five in innings in the league. So maybe they have to use an opener for it. It's going to look like a good idea, but I think Burke is probably a good route to go, especially if what he feels like has helped him mechanically is going to have him sitting at a higher velocity, contrary to what your, you know, granddad might say. Velocity always helps a little bit. So if he can sit above 95, I think that provides some margin for error for his command, which Will Venable has harped on as being the thing for him.
Well, he hit 99.8 miles per hour, as we mentioned in our last podcast episode. Burke did in his last outing at home. James, was Radish the pitcher for the Orioles,
oh, yes,
which Pedro Grifol kind of
already thinking about it?
I'm doubling down.
I was thinking of ways, to be kind of like, not say it, but be like, while we're breaking up with Will pregame Monday, be like, just keep your head about this one. You know, anything can happen in a baseball game. Don't need to overreact to any results.
And Corey Lee's back, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was Corey Lee that was like, I don't think so.
he can have his opinion. We have a different opinion.
Yeah.
Rough bear for pretty.
Oh, which, the beginning of the end for Pedro.
First fully in the majors. Not an outspoken dude.
From a Baltimore perspective, Jim, it's been a pretty disappointing 2025 season for the Orioles. We talked about in the last episode that they were thinking about the idea of approaching Josh Barfield for their general manager position, and he declined to interview for that opening. What course of action do you see the Orioles taking in the offseason?
Good question. It seems like it's really hard to shake Mike Elias out of his like conservative prospect hoarding mode, like very much a long-term. He doesn't seem like he wants to lose a trade or like is willing to lose a trade. Like AJ Preller doesn't want to lose trades, but he's comfortable losing a trade because he makes so many of them that like he can't possibly go 28 for 28 in his deals and he makes over the course of 3 months. So like he deals in volume, and ultimately he sees his way of getting better is like things are, you know, there are going to be some ugly turns, but when the smoke clears, my team's going to be better than it was. And I think Elias is maybe on the other end of just being very nervous about losing the wrong prospect and worrying that one's going to backfire on him and he's going to be, you know, have the lesser prospect on his hands. So he just kind of sits on him for a long time. And then, you know, guys come up like, Mayo is one of them. Just use, I don't know how many deals he was included in over the years when trying to figure out trade partners to add pitching. And like, he's not making that much of an, you know, impression right now. Like, he's allowed to struggle. Like he's, you know, young players are allowed to take their time getting acclimated, but for a team that's supposed to win now, like when you're not getting those performances from those players you're hoarding, then you do miss out on getting the proven player who doesn't necessarily need that kind of runway to take off. So like I'm inclined, having seen, you know, two Rickon rebuilds fail, to where you can't count on a tiger changing his stripes and you can't count on him changing out of his mode. If he does, maybe it doesn't go well because that's not who he is. I also have the theory, you know, kind of a rule of thumb in that like each general manager gets 5 years. And then like, if it works out well, they get another 5 years. And in this case of Elias, like this, you know, he's, I don't know if he has a second idea. And so I'm really, I'm not concerned. Yeah, I'm concerned, yeah, for Orioles fans, because I think they deserve better than what they've gotten. But I don't have a whole lot of confidence that somebody whose philosophy seems very clear can all of a sudden pivot into something more fruitful. And I think it's, you know, kind of disappointing that new ownership really hasn't poured gas on it either. Like that's the, I think the other surprising thing is like, I would expect maybe the ownership to look at Elias and say like, why aren't you doing more? You're not under the Angeloses anymore, and make something happen. And, you know, Rubenstein doesn't seem very, trigger happy. Maybe that'll be for the better at some point, but right now it's just like, they seem like they're still crying small market. So yeah, they've turned into one of the cautionary tales for the White Sox whenever Justin Ishbia takes over. You know, don't count on the next guy being better, because look what happened in Miami. Look at what happened in Baltimore. So Yeah, I don't know, just because what we do know hasn't worked, and perhaps they just keep going to that because they don't have any ideas.
It just
To
really.
Jim's point, when I was sorting through when Josh Rojas got DFA'd, and I was trying to check to see if he had been like the lowest WAR for the American League, and like Heston Kerstad was right next to him. I thought like that shouldn't be here. That's not a good sign. I looked over at Baltimore too much, but if this is how far the debris is like flying from the blast zone, this is not good.
No. Is Heston still on the major league roster, or did he
I
get
don't think
demoted?
so.
Yeah. Yeah. And just looking at like Baseball Reference, as far as the like the their MLB draft efforts, the last time that the Orioles used a first round pick on a pitcher was Grayson Rodriguez, which it's been difficult for him to stay on the field. That's the part for the Orioles that I'm just not understanding, Jim. It is clear they have a need for pitching, but at the same time, all these hitters as well just seem to take like a step backwards this year for Baltimore. Like, they're not that big of a threat offensively as I was expecting them to be.
I wonder if Ryan Fuller, I don't know if I probably wouldn't go on the record in saying so. Probably keep it to trusted contacts, but I wonder if he's relieved to be away from it because he got all the blame, or that the two hitting coaches got blamed for their problems with hitting and runner with runners in scoring position, and just, oh, clearly this philosophy doesn't work and they need new hitting voices, and then they've been way worse in all regards, like even setting up scoring opportunities. Like, I guess one of my having seen enough White Sox offenses struggle to even generate opportunities, I don't get too worked up about average execution in such situations until it's like proven maybe a couple years of having the data that they get on base, they just can't do anything with it, or they're very easy to pitch to in those situations. But yeah, I just wonder if he's pretty comfortable now just kind of going to the roving mode and not having his reputation stake to major league results when perhaps right now we're seeing that some of the roster doesn't work.
I think he's termed it more of being happy to work with young players than free from being from judgment. Or I thought you were going to say something more wild, like what's the pronunciation of the wooden shoe for sabotage, like Sabo, and that he was going to be like whacking the trajectory with it on the way his way out or something like that.
I mean, maybe since you've entered in the record, let that be clear. Like, oh, James has talked to him, so I assume it's coming from somewhere that he has that in him.
I've never seen him wearing wooden worker shoes.
Well, now we have this idea, James. Pitch it to Ryan next time you see him at the stadium. You know, Ryan, you should wear wooden shoes when you're around.
Not anymore.
Well, we'll recap what happens between the White Sox and Orioles later this week and then preview the weekend series against the San Diego Padres in our mid-week podcast episode. But for this episode, and I think for a lot, any podcast that you listen to about Major League Baseball, suddenly things have changed. A month ago, I thought Jim nailed it. The MLB postseason races really felt like they were already predetermined. And nothing was really too close. Teams that were trying to fight for the division, sitting in second place, still had a cushion in the wild card. There wasn't that much of a worry. Well, now, all of a sudden, things have really turned, especially in the National League, where the New York Mets, I don't even know if the Mets are going to finish above 500. Like, that is a serious question right now. They've taken a big step backwards. In the American League West, the Seattle Mariners have won 9 straight games, and they have overtaken Houston for the first time to lead the American League West since June 1st. And that's where we're going to start taking a look at the playoff races in Major League Baseball with 12 games left to go. And hopefully these races still stay tight because it really makes for great baseball and catches everyone's attention. So other than watching the White Sox develop, there's still a big reason for us to keep watching what is happening around Major League Baseball. Starting the American League West, the Seattle Mariners now lead that division by a game over the Houston Astros with an 82 and 68 record. The Astros are 81 and 69. And here come the Texas Rangers. The Texas Rangers have won 7 out of 3. They're 79 and 71. They're 3 games back in the division, and they're 2 games back of the wild card. the remaining schedule. We're going to hear a lot about this, especially if you're watching MLB Network. Seattle has a upcoming road trip to Kansas City and to Houston. They finished the year 3 games against the Rockies and then 3 games against the Dodgers. That's how Seattle finishes their season. Houston has their last homestand this week. It's 3 against the Rangers, 3 against the Mariners. So a lot of attention in Major League Baseball will be in Houston this week. And the Astros will finish the season on the road, visiting Sacramento and Anaheim. And for the Rangers, again, 3 at Houston, and then at home, 3 against the Marlins, 3 against the Twins. And they end the season 3 games at Cleveland. Seattle owns a tiebreaker over Texas. Texas owns the tiebreaker over Houston right now in case if these teams tie for the division leagues. Again, there's no game 163. So, Jim, I'll start with you. When it comes to the American League West right now, who are you most confident in winning this division?
Nobody, just because I've always gotten this division wrong. Like every time I'm about
it
to
is
say,
hard.
Yeah. Like the Rangers, I was ready to count them out because they've just lost so many people. Like they lost Nady Eovaldi. They lost Marcus Semien. They lost Evan Carter. They've lost names they were counting on. Like if you expected a Rangers resurgence, you would expect like those three to be at the center of it. And then they all end up on the injured list and then they're playing their best baseball. So like I've given up on them in a good way. Like, just like, I don't know, you know, I'm just going to check the box scores every day and then see what happens and be surprised no matter what. I guess the one thing, you know, it makes sense that they're somewhat in this random mode because like Jake Berger went off, or he's been going off with power. He seems like the guy you want in this kind of situation when you just need impact. Over the full season, been kind of a disappointing year for him, but he is still capable of having like 3 great weeks where he hits the ball 117 miles per hour and terrifies the outfield. And it just happens to be like in his first year with the White Sox, like perfectly timed to be exactly what you need for a short burst. And like the Rangers need it right now. So that's really cool to see. You're happy for the Mariners, you know, given that they added the deadline, that they had a really aggressive deadline. I want to see that payoff. So I am pulling for them, I think, of those three teams. But yeah, whenever I express confidence in one team or another, it inevitably, I think Jeff Passan too has had this problem of just it inevitably backfires and you look foolish like within the week. So I don't know, but I have reasons to like pull for individual teams, but feeling like one is better than the other, not so much. But I am hoping for Seattle just because of the very sensible deadline that they had that was exciting, and they had every reason to do it and they did it. And as we just talked about the Orioles, that sometimes doesn't happen. So when it happens, you try to celebrate it. So go M's.
James, how about you? How do you feel about the American League West?
Well, my cousin is a big Yankees fan, and he wanted me to tell him who's going to be in the World Series. And I picked the Mariners because I knew if I picked the Yankees, he wouldn't take me seriously because he has this undying skepticism of them. I think has been there since like 1997 and survived and even gotten stronger through multiple World Series championships. So I feel like it's pretty coin flip in a lot of ways. And the Astros, you kind of aren't really banking on anything rational there. It's just their track record of survival. Theoretically, they shouldn't have had the horses to get this far with the Rangers and the injuries. It's such a short period of time that's kind of within the margin of error. But I think the Mariners are the team that has like the elite players still standing in operational order where you can see them kind of being able to accelerate to a degree that other teams shouldn't have at this moment. But it's 12 games. It's 12 regular season games at the end of September. A lot of weird nonsense can happen, and it won't necessarily be a pure meritocracy from here out, which is kind of why the sport is fun.
And to that point, like, I feel like Houston, when you're looking at the remaining schedule, should have the edge, even though Seattle does have a series against the Rockies, because you're hosting the Rangers and Mariners at home. And then your road games are at Sacramento, which who knows how those games will go. The Athletics have been hitting really well at home as of late. And then three games against the Angels, in which they're running out of players to even field a team. I don't even know who would be on the Angels for these final three games. I feel like Houston should have the edge in the remaining schedule just because they are hosting the Rangers and Mariners at home. But to James's point, Jim, there's not a lot of rational, because even here, also your point, like the American League West has been so random. It's been week by week, it seems like, this year.
I guess if you're looking for like one reason why it's, you know, if you're looking, try to not just write it off as random and look for some kind of through line, like Julio Rodriguez looks great. You know, he's looked great for the second half, and theoretically he's been sold as that kind of superstar, the kind of galvanizing force, you know, up the middle player, you know, tremendous offensive ceiling. Hasn't really happened in a way that's been satisfying, to where you start questioning like, oh, is he just a good player, but not like a superstar that deserves like the mega long contract? And like, he's lived up to that in the second half. And like, given all the other ways they fortify the roster, and Cal Raleigh setting records for switch hitters with homers, like, it does seem like Rodriguez realizing the potential he's had all along at this given time would be something that would put them over the top in a way that they would eventually get to distance themselves from the rest of the division. And then you wait for October, you know, that randomness to happen. But
right.
I do like that angle as far as why this is meaningfully different, as opposed to just Seattle being weird.
From doing the Astros prospect list, I have too much carryover memory of six or seven different guys where it's like, I don't really think this is regular here. As of list publication, he has been called up and put into emergency duty. And just thinking that this seems like it's at the end. But it's never at the end for them, so who knows?
Well, over in the wild card, so whoever wins division is looking to be the number three seed in the American League, as Toronto and Detroit have a pretty firm grasp on the top two seeds. Right now, if the season were to end today, the postseason would be going through Toronto. In the wild card, Boston, thanks to an outstanding start by Garrett Crochet on Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN, Boston was able to salvage one win at home against the Yankees. The Yankees still, though, have the lead on the fourth seed. They're 83-66. The Red Sox are a game and a half back of the Yankees with an 82-68 record. Right now, the Astros would be your sixth seed at 81-69, followed by the Rangers. And thanks to sweeping the White Sox, the Guardians are there 2.5 games back of the Astros for the final wild card. The remaining schedule, the Yankees might have one of the easiest 12-game stretches left in Major League Baseball. Three at the Twins, which they absolutely own the Minnesota Twins. Four at Baltimore. Three at home against the White Sox. And three at home against the Orioles. Yeah, the Yankees don't have to worry. Boston, three at home against the Athletics. They go on the road to Tampa and then Toronto, and they finish the season three games at home against the Detroit Tigers. That is not an easy stretch for the Red Sox. And then the Guardians have a road trip coming up, three in Detroit, four in Minnesota, three at home against the Tigers again, and then three against the Rangers. That's also a tough stretch for the Guardians. Jim, let's keep it within the division. Looking at the Guardians, after sweeping the White Sox and being 2.5 games back, are they a serious challenger here of sneaking into the wild card?
I don't think so, just because it is unimpressive the way they win. And there's a talent to that, but also they're below 500 against all the other teams besides the White Sox. Like, they're 67-69. We've seen the Twins kind of run out of steam the same way, just beating up the White Sox and not quite getting there. And given the strength of the teams, given that the Rangers are in between, if maybe the Guardians were the nearest team to the final wildcard spot, I could see a stronger argument, but just having that fourth team in the way also playing well, I don't see enough that's impressive about them to really stand out or believe that they can do it, aside from just being a well-rounded team baseball playing team that doesn't lose games, but they can be beaten.
Do you agree with that, James?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the AL has been, I certainly don't see it on like their own merits of like, oh boy, this looks like such an exciting operation. I certainly think there's like instability with I tried to assure my cousin that I really didn't see the Yankees like falling out of the sky any further than it did. But like in terms of like, could the Astros fall apart that like opens up that that final spot, or even could have the Red Sox been weird enough this year, and obviously dealing without Roman Anthony, not really having like a very consistent offense since then. It's unstable enough that they could sneak in. Certainly, I don't think they're like in division range, but I think they can kind of, over the course of 12 games, especially with like how consistently they like keep low scoring games in play, I could see them treading water in some way that, puts them around to be opportunistic, but I don't see like a 9-3 surge necessarily. Though I think like Guardians have like aggregated one of my tweets in like their 2022 like division celebration graphic at the end. So I'm worried about giving. Please just cite Sox Machine if you do it again this time.
I did not know that. I did not know that. Again, the Guardians have won 9 of their last 10 games. They are on a 4-game winning streak right now. So they are one of the hottest teams in Major League Baseball entering this final stretch. Jim, I know you've been a critic of the way that the postseason has expanded because it could allow a lesser team into the postseason. But the way that things are working out in the American League, I'm thinking it's going to take like 89 wins to be that sixth seed to make the postseason. Is that a good win total to earn that postseason spot?
It's better than it looked, with especially at the Mariners picking it up and the Red Sox doing the same. Like when it looked like it was like 83 and the Royals were a legitimate outsider, like outside the bubble, but looming like 2 games out. That's when, yeah, I think the Royals are probably the bar for they've been competitive, feisty, but also some glaring weaknesses that
They can't score.
They can't score. Yeah, the outfield has been miserable. Like Caglione didn't solve it. So like they're two horse offense. Something that works for Cleveland or has worked for Cleveland for long stretches of time is not working for them. And so yeah, to see them at 500 and see them 6 games back of the wild card spot, like that makes me comfortable. When they were just looming on the outside and kind of jockeying back and forth to Cleveland, that made me think like, why are either of these teams around and able to factor in the postseason? So it is better. In the case of like the National League, which we'll get to with the Mets, like somebody like begging to take the third wild card spot, that's like, why even bother having three at that point? Like just have a bar that they need to clear, and if they don't reach it, then extra buy or figure it out. But that's when it's disheartening to know that one of these teams will get in.
So you both like the Mariners to win the American League West. Do you think the Astros hold on to that final wild card spot, Jim?
I'll say yes, just because I don't necessarily understand how the other teams are doing it. I don't understand the way the Astros are doing it either, but in the case of the way they performed and the way they've overcome self-inflicted wounds before, like I trust their track record in confusing me more than the other two teams.
I mean, the Mariners have been underperforming, disappointing for decades, like with far more loaded rosters than this one. Like the level to which they won with Alex Rodriguez, Ken Griffey Jr., and Randy Johnson, it's astounding. I don't even understand how they're 82 and 68. So, and I feel like I'm kind of touching the hot stove for like a 17th time by being like, why wouldn't it work? While looking at the roster and ignoring like 30 years of it not working. So I don't know if I like the Mariners to do it. I think they should, but I've thought they should for a while. I really don't know how they wasted all of Jay Buhner's prime, kind of like we're really gonna open it up.
I just write it off as travel, like plane miles, I guess.
Okay. That's better than Witch's Curse or the other options I'm kicking around. I'll say the Astros just because like they can't be killed. They'll find themselves into a postseason somehow. And not really that bullish on the Guardians, who obviously, we saw their ability to kind of pitch around it, this weekend, but they did take big blows to their depth that in ways that you could see it even manifesting in terms of like running out of gas in the final week, with the way they just had holes punched in their pitching staff.
So, as a betting man, I have a Texas Rangers winning the American League pennant bet that pays out 25-1. So I am rooting for the Rangers to sneak into the playoffs. So let's go, Bruce Bochy. Work your magic. Figure it out. Win that series in Houston. They may have to sweep the Astros.
I thought that was an Emmanuel Class A reference.
No. Going from Guardians to as a betting man. Wow, smooth segue. Smooth but brutal.
But it would be, that's one reason why it's cool to see the Guardians doing what they're doing, because
everything they overcame.
Such a stupid mistake and seeing the individuals like suffer consequences, but like the team being like, yeah, pretty dumb. Like, you know, but you know, not bad enough to sink it, because like if individuals are falling prey to, you know, gambling, it's just another thing that can motivate them, is like, you are replaceable no matter who you are, no matter like being an all-star closer, Cy Young vote getting closer. And, you shoot your, you basically like, destroy your own career, and then they move on without you. Like, yeah, not a bad motivation to stake.
I do feel connected with the Guardians, as and we both overcome getting nothing from Lane Thomas this season. So
how is that? I'm
they should aggregate that if they make the
yeah. How's your fantasy team doing?
Into the finals. Thanks for asking, Josh.
Wow. Congratulations. Your strategy's working. Be awful or be mediocre.
13-9 was good enough to win the worst division in the league, and now we're on to whatever team I play next.
All right. Texas, that's how you need to be for me. All right. Follow the James Fegan path. Sneak in and win the American League pennant for me. That'd be great.
That's right. And hey, is it in on the agenda? But I don't know. Shane Smith's been great recently. That's all I'll say.
You pat him on the back when you see him. Rub his shoulders.
Just a little wink.
Just like corner man talk.
The last thing I do want to chime in on the Guardians, Stephen Vogt, the manager of the Guardians, he did catch some heat during the season when the Guardians were struggling. But I view him as a really good manager. I didn't know what to expect when the Guardians hired him to replace Terry Francona. I thought that was, you never want to be the next guy to replace a very successful manager in any sport, even like head coach as well. But I think he's done an excellent job with the Guardians.
I wonder if baseball is a little bit different in that regard, because like Pat Murphy replaced Craig Counsell.
Yes.
Did just fine. Joe Espada has been doing pretty well, all things considered, given some of the end of era transitions that the Astros have had to go through. Like, he's done remarkably well. So I wonder if baseball is a case where if you have a good front office that knows what it wants the manager to be and how they, you know, funnel information through it, and how they, you know, try to allocate the talent for that manager. Like, I wonder if that's easier to do than like trying to transplant a manager and then like make it work. Craig Counsell, yeah. You know, make it work. Joe Girardi, and places where the infrastructure above them isn't as solid.
Well, the Milwaukee Brewers, to that point, as we segue over to the National League, the Brewers have already clinched a playoff spot. The Philadelphia Phillies magic number is 1. So things are being determined in the National League. In the National League West right now, the Dodgers have a 2.5 game lead over the San Diego Padres. The Dodgers are 84-65, while the Padres are 82-68. It's not an easy schedule for the Dodgers. So this upcoming homestand, their last of the season, 3 against the Phillies, and then 4 against the Giants. But the Dodgers did handle their business in San Francisco this weekend. They end the year at Arizona and then again at Seattle. The Padres, 3 games at the Mets. I don't know what to make of that series anymore. Then they're in Chicago to face the White Sox. But then they come home against the Brewers and Diamondbacks. So that would be a bit tough for the Padres and how this season ends. Jim, this feels like the Dodgers have this wrapped up. I think it's just too much ground for the Padres to overcome the Dodgers in the final 12 games, I should say. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, it's a case where like the tiebreaker makes a big difference. Having that extra game, like game, if there were game 163, and I do miss the game 163s, that's another reason why the new postseason format kind of annoys me. I think that you know, he might be able to close that gap, but having to win the extra game makes a lot harder. And I think we've seen that manifest itself before, just looming large when that three-game gap is actually four. It's hard to do.
Yeah, especially when you don't have any games against each other.
Yeah.
That makes it a lot more difficult. So when you look over to the National League wild card, so the Cubs are in good shape. They're 8.5 games ahead of the New York Mets for the final wild card spot. So even though they're not going to win the National League Central, the Cubs are in a healthy spot to host that wild card series, the best of three at Wrigley Field, followed by the Padres and the New York Mets. The New York Mets are now 77-73. They have lost 8 of their last 10 games. And now they have invited teams like the San Francisco Giants, the Arizona Diamondbacks, and the Cincinnati Reds, who are currently below 500. These teams hovering around 500 are within 3 games of the New York Mets of making the postseason. James, let's say the improbable happens and the Mets don't make it into the postseason. Is this going to be one of the biggest surprises in 2025 when looking at Major League Baseball?
I suppose so. Yeah, the Mets were supposed to be good again and obviously spent and dominated the news cycle to an outsized degree. I think I don't want to come off as minimizing the importance of spending, because obviously it dictates so much about the power of the game. It's more just my grievance with the way the sport is covered, especially in the off season, where activity gets equated to this team is good, kind of automated. It's talked about kind of the end all be all, as opposed to a supplement to actually assessing organizational depth, which no one really seems to have the patience or appetite to do, and kind of centering around what kind of impact a single star player has, which is, at the same time, if you start speaking up about that too much, you start to kind of give a allowance or forgiveness or excuse to teams to pretend the reason they're not spending money is because they're above it, or they're thinking more deeply about team construction. Really, it's really a route to cheap out. But from a cynical baseball writer standpoint, yes, we got Mets shoved down our throat because they were the center of the biggest news story and the chase and this whole suitor process and consuming the sport like a business drama, rather than anything that's relevant about the mechanics of it between the lines and all sorts of things that I don't have the biggest appetite for. Surely it's tempting to explain this is why you should have listened to all the people who are writing about David Peterson's four seam shape or something else you didn't find interesting at the time, because now it matters. But I definitely, to hop onto a different hobby horse, right now, despite the Mets looking like the worst thing ever and generally looking like they're trending towards disaster, which is simultaneously being covered this big shocking thing, because obviously we all had bigger expectations. I'm sure I predicted them to be a postseason team. That's coming alongside some national writers of note saying, why do Fangraphs playoff prediction odds still have the Mets evaluated as likely make the playoffs? Can't they see that they're just falling out of the sky? It's well, no, that's the computer. The whole purpose of doing statistical projections are not so there's a number that correlates with what you're seeing and feeling from day-to-day reactions. It's to ground it in based on what is established as this team strength, they should perform to this level. So based on the way the Mets have performed in the past and their pedigree and their statistical production, they look a lot better than these teams, which is the bedrock of why we thought they were going to be good in the first place, which is why them losing and falling apart is a noteworthy response. So of course our statistical predictors of what's the likely thing to happen are not going to be reflecting this thing we're all talking about, how unlikely it is. So that's two.
I love it. I
about
love
how
it.
I hate a lot of sports media coverage packed into one. I feel like sometimes I'm like that Seinfeld character who becomes who Jewish for the jokes, I became a sports writer to talk about how much I hate sports media. But I can do it. I can say it.
I love it. I love it. Giants, Diamondbacks, Reds. Out of these three teams, Jim, who do you think can seriously overtake the Mets as the final wildcard team?
I feel like they're not going to overtake the Mets as so much as the Mets are going to slip under them. Like, they're okay teams, but they knew at the deadline they weren't good. And like, they all acted accordingly. And so
the Giants, though, I mean, after they acquired Rafael Devers, I still thought they had some hope.
Yeah, I mean, like, they were well positioned in terms of like adding Devers. Yeah, that's a long term play.
That's right. Yeah.
But they also, they at the deadline, they're like, oh, this isn't quite working out. We have Devers, but now we're in terms of short term plays, not necessarily going for it. So the Reds, like, they had a bad offense. They didn't do anything to address the offense. The Diamondbacks trade players, like, I'm not pulling for any of them. Like, yeah, in terms of motivations, like, I like seeing like the Mariners case of just a good team fortifying itself, exciting its fans, and then a payoff for those fans and the decision makers. So this does nothing for the whole make a good team better mindset that I have when teams can back into the postseason by accident because of like the Mets. I think the surprising thing for me is like not the Mets are collapsing, but like they're collapsing twice. Like that they had the scare in the middle of the season and you think like, oh, they normalized, like the Yankees normalized and the Yankees had that scare at the same time. And now the Yankees look like, if not what they hoped they would be by winning the East, at least like a good baseball team that's going to be in October and has as good a chance as anybody. Like the Mets, you know, to have that happen twice with the resources they have, I think that's the shocking thing. And, you know, giving Carlos Mendoza the vote of confidence is kind of fascinating in that market. Speaking of like transplants, David Stearns, like going from, you know, Milwaukee to the Mets, you know, it worked for Andrew Friedman and the Dodgers. So, you know, perhaps it will still work for Stearns, but in the case of like one market and one market's pressures being vastly different from the other market and its pressures. And I think with Friedman, the fear was like, how is he going to spend when he's so used to like not having money to spend? Is he going to like go into a whole bunch of bad contracts because he, you know, he doesn't have this governor over him? And like, that didn't happen with him, but you know, maybe it's to a certain extent happening with the Mets of just being pressured to spend and pressured to add and make big news. And like, maybe it's a case of Stearns getting his sea legs when it comes to having a margin, but also like still staking within like a budget of, you know, making sure that you're not paying just excess for okay players and committing the playing time for those okay players.
Yeah. Look at the games that are remaining, because the Giants this year finish at home with 3 against the Cardinals and 3 against the Rockies. They have a tough road trip. But James, I know you've been on the Diamondbacks bandwagon at times. I'm not sure how they're doing this. What would it say if the Diamondbacks were to catch the Mets and make it to the postseason, especially with the teardown that they had at the trade deadline and still making the playoffs? That would be amazing.
I don't get to watch them a lot. I obviously like their offensive tools.
Yeah, Corbin Carroll's been red hot.
You know, you check in with some random game, you see something that may not be their typical thing. But I watched the end of a Diamondbacks game, and they tried to protect the 2-run lead with Jake Woodford. I don't see them overtaking the Mets. Josh, back to you.
Wow. No confidence in Jake Woodford. Wow.
Well, he faced 4 batters. He didn't get anyone out, and they lost the game to the Twins.
Yeah, we've seen that.
Don't have a lot themselves.
No, right they now. Don't. No, they don't. All right. So the Mets should hold on.
I think the Diamondbacks are a pitching staff where you may be seeing what they traded away a little bit.
Okay. Yeah.
In their from the relief corps.
Yeah, we saw with the Tigers a little bit last year, like trading away, giving up on the season, and like rallying. And a lot of it was just very successful problem solving and But also, I think it showed just how unlikely the Tigers run was that they were able to staple together so many effective pitching games with leftovers and two innings at a time, which nobody counted on. And I think, it was hard to do last year. So Hinch deserves a lot of credit. And, the Tigers backed it up really well by, adding and getting next steps in development. So they, I think, are, a pleasing counterpoint to the idea of just sticking with what you have and playing the long game. And like they've stuck with players that they have, but also like they made Spencer Torkelson earn it. Casey Mize having to go from the outside in, and Matt Manning shedding him when he wasn't working. Like they've been able to shed parts and they haven't worked. And I think that's something that's worked for them.
And then lastly, with the National League, you got Bob Melvin in San Francisco. You got Terry Francona in Cincinnati. Do you guys see either of them suddenly finding the magic in these last 12 games and motivating their team into the postseason? Would that be a factor?
I doubt it. One, like, I don't know, Melvin's looked a little, I should have better sources than just Tom Fornelli texting me complaints as he tries to pretend to be a Giants fan. But he seems a little like slow on bullpen moves compared to like the modern game a little bit. It's more like 2018 approach there. And sometimes the rotation dictates it, but sometimes it doesn't. Terry Francona, just that Reds team hasn't, not to take anything away from him, but it hasn't had like this jolt in response like, oh, we got our act together in some, measurable way now that we have this Hall of Fame manager all year. I'd wonder where it's coming from if it happened now. Like didn't like advance to some like higher level of play or unlock some like new approach that made a bunch of players like click to some new levels. Like in some respects, like they've had a bunch of guys who I thought were really going to hit, like Spencer Steer or Christian Ignacio Stran, who like, if it started coming together at any moment, I would be like, yeah, just like I thought. But like, why would it happen in mid-September? I'd be a little, if it hasn't kind of clicked all year, I'd be kind of surprised. Health.
I could see like maybe the Giants, just because they've overperformed in their unique run scoring or offensive environment. Their success doesn't often look like traditional success. So, in a season where you're not seeing anybody want this spot, like I could see the, and the Giants have some good name brand frontline players still around too that can, drive the offense or the pitching staff for a week or two. So I could see them mounting a threat based on what they have and what they've been able to do, but they also weren't particularly interested in doing it until like the Mets, just open up this opportunity for them. So I think, to go back to what I said originally, just it'll be more about the Mets just being a story that's going to resonate for years among that fan base of just like, why bother caring about any team? Remember the 2025 Mets? Just the way like they, Carlos Beltran looking at strike three, they have specific failures that just never get forgotten. And this would be one of them.
Yeah, they
end the team's piecing it together in odd ways. The Padres have gotten 8 2/3 scoreless innings out of the bullpen recently from White Sox 40-man roster move legend Ron Marinaccio, who just got called up, who I think like was a part of like 6 White Sox roster moves while never pitching. Even the teams that are seemingly secure in the race are kind of throwing the most desperate things at the wall in terms of like how they were acquired and where they came from.
Yeah, I'm going to save that conversation when we actually know who makes the postseason. The playoff games could be chaos, especially on the pitching front. The Tigers, they got some good news with Tarek Skubal, because if they lost Skubal, I don't know what they would be doing heading into the postseason. That would be
sure it's nothing that will pop up again over the course of 30 to 40 more extremely high leverage innings.
Nope, not at all.
Pitched at not maximum at all. Intensity.
We'll see what happens this week. Again, a lot of eyes will be in Houston as they have back-to-back series against the Rangers and Mariners, so we should have a clearer picture maybe in the American League West, and we'll see What the Mets do is they host the Padres to start this week, and we'll keep tabs on this as we get closer to the end of the regular season. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sox Machine. We're on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. James will be at the stadium this week. You can follow him at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We are expecting the end of the season press conference with Chris Getz this week, James.
Friday.
So again, if you're not following James, make sure you do. And of course, James will have all of those quotes from Chris Getz on SoxMachine.com. Speaking of being able to read those quotes and read James's work, you can become a Sox Machine subscriber by signing up at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5 that unlocks all access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball. Also gives you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website and access to the comment section. We do have a couple spots open at our Veterans Committee, so if you want direct access with the group chat to James and Jim, and also be asked for advice on how we do things at Sox Machine with the offseason coming up and getting ready for the 2026 season, we lean on our VC members for feedback and advice. We do have some spots open you can inquire at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.